Hello, my name is Veronika Kasova. I live in Edinburgh and I just graduated with a Master's in Psychology of Mental Health. Marion recommended me the Clinical Psychologist Collective when I was networking on LinkedIn, and I must say I love it. It is one of a kind. It's like a window into the lives of people on the path of becoming a psychologist. The stories are unique, honest, and filled with a kind of intangible wisdom only personal storytelling can uncover. A common thread in the stories I valued most was to be compassionate not only with others, but with myself too. Also, not fixating on becoming a psychologist, but enjoying life, growth, and the final results will come as a byproduct. Marianne, thank you for taking the time to collate all the stories. The book is a true gem, and I think every aspiring psychologist should have a copy on their shelf. Thank you.
If you're looking to become a psychologist, then let this be your guide. With this podcast at your side, you'll be on your way to being qualified. It's the Aspiring Psychologist Podcast. Dr. Marianne Trent.
Hi, welcome along to the Aspiring Psychologist podcast. Thank you for listening, and thank you once again for being part of my world. Thank you also to everybody who has been in contact to say how useful they have found the Clinical Psychologist Collective book and, of course, the Aspiring Psychologist membership in supporting their application process in psychology this year. And there have been a few success stories as well within the membership of people getting onto clinical training, and also people who found reading the Clinical Psychologist Collective book really helpful in helping them develop their own confidence in talking about their narratives and in reflecting and being able to draw on strengths and experiences across their career. So if you haven't grabbed a copy yet, or if you're not yet on the waiting list for the Aspiring Psychologist membership, then do check out the details in the show notes so that you can go and check it all out on my link tree. But with no further ado, whilst we're talking about the Clinical Psychologist Collective, why not meet someone who is featured in the book, but not in the capacity of clinical psychology? Let's think about other routes to professional qualifications in psychology. In today's podcast episode, I am joined by Dr. Michelle McDowell, who is an educational and child psychologist. She's lovely to chat to, and I hope you'll find this episode super useful. I will catch you on the other side.
Okay, welcome along. I am joined today by my wonderful guest, Dr. Michelle McDowell. Michelle is an educational psychologist. Hi, welcome along, Michelle.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Marianne.
You're so welcome. So what I think can be really useful is if we give the audience a flavour of where you're at right now, but also a little bit of a potted history about how you got there and why.
Okay, I'll try to remember and recall all of that all in one. So, like you said, Marianne, I'm an education and child psychologist. I didn't go directly to that route, and I'll tell you why. When I first trained many years ago now, so in 2000, I trained as a psychologist, you had to be a teacher first. So I did my teacher training, and by the way, before I did teacher training, I had no clue of what I wanted to do. And so somebody was saying to me, oh, you know, the PGCE is 1 year. And at the time, it was very well funded. So I was like, right, okay, this sounds great. So I did the PGCE for the year and was trained to teach government and politics and history, although I had aspects of psychology within my initial degree. So I went along to teach training. After that, started on my teaching career in secondary school. And in my very, very first term, I was a form tutor, right? In my very first term of teaching, I had a pupil who was a lovely young man in year seven. Never forget him. He was, you know, just really sporty, actually, and just a joyous young man, really bubbly in the class. Struggled with literacy, just couldn't get to engage with literacy. And of quite a few of his teachers, secondary school, obviously, so, you know, would comment and say, he's got all the answers, but it's really struggling. So the SENCO, I'd had a discussion with the special education needs coordinator, the SENCO, and she'd organised for the educational psychologist to come into school. And during the consultation, I said to her, can you tell me what exactly is it that you do? And after an elongated conversation, I had my aha moment. And that was it. I was like, this is my calling. This is what I'm supposed to do, educational psychology. So I then continued on the journey. Now, I want to make a distinction because it's very different now. But my journey through to the training to become an educational psychologist, like I said at the beginning, was you needed some teaching experience. So I'd already started on that journey. I had a degree that had some aspects of psychology in it, but not enough to get the GBR status. So I then had to do an initial master's in psychology. And then it wasn't quite a diploma, but I guess it was a certificate in the additional topics that you needed to become a to get that GBR status. And then I applied to be an educational psychologist. Now that sounds like quite a simple route, but it took years because I was studying part-time. I'm going on and on here. Do you want me to continue?
Sure, absolutely. Mm-hmm. How old were you when you started your education? I'm sorry, what a question. Does that feel okay to ask you that question?
Of course, I'm confident in my womanhood and agehood, as they say. I don't know, let me think now, because I did my doctorate later. So actually, let me carry on with the journey. So when I trained, you needed a Master in Science, the MSc, to become an education and child psychologist. So it was many moons ago. So I think I did the MA and then the MSc. And I think by the time 2000, how old would I have been? 30. Yeah, I was fully qualified.
You were not hanging around, were you? You know, you did your teaching qualification and you did all of the stuff you needed to do to be able to qualify as an ed psych at 30. That's some going.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, I spent much longer in teaching because I loved it. So there was quite a bit of, do I go, do I not go? Because I really, really enjoy teaching. But it was changing. And it was at that stage that they were making adjustments in the curriculum again, and it was much more sort of paper-based, and I was like, it's probably a good time to, you know, transfer and change, really. And so I chose to do it then in 2000.
I love that actually it was a personal story, a personal connection, something that you could tangibly almost feel and connect to that really turned your head in the direction of educational psychology. And, you know, I think it is... Oh, it's one of my favourite things about this profession of psychology of ours is that we get to work with people, you know, who can shape us as well as hopefully we have a positive impact on them as well. But that young man might never know, you know, that actually
absolutely
the impact he had on you. And it's really incredible. But I'm really pleased it happened because it did, you know, lead you towards this new passion.
Absolutely. I think about my life, actually, there have been these significant moments, as I'm sure it is for everybody else, and often personal, that have impacted and triggered moving on to something new, you know, or certainly a change and transition. So, yeah, definitely.
It's important that we can reflect on that, can't we? Have you ever done any, you know, journaling or diary kind of keeping to help you with your reflections, or how do you manage your reflections if you don't do that?
Do you know, it's really interesting you ask. I used to journal quite a bit. I used to write poetry, actually. And then I used to journal almost, I think, daily for years and years and years and years. And after I had my son, so about, about 10 years ago now, isn't it? I paused and then just kind of have done it intermittently, but not quite ever got consistently back into it. And I miss it. And so I think maybe I'm going to start again. I think.
It's never too late to start again, is it? But, you know, it's recognising the stuff that's been useful along our journey and then thinking, oh, I might do that again, you know? What form did you used to do it? Did you do it kind of at the end of your day? Would you do it at the beginning of the day or a little bit of, you know, ad hoc here and there?
I think there were phases. So I think when I was much younger, I used to do it at the end of the day. And it used to be almost a kind of a reflection on what I'd experienced each day. And then I think sort of post-degree around that time, it used to be something that I did quite early on in the morning, and it was more intentional. So I used to focus on what I wanted the day to look like, and it was much more focused. And then I went through a period of time that was very intentional, and I got into the more the neuropsychology of it all, really. And, you know, that kind of focused intent and being, having gratitude and, you know. And so it would be preempt, you know, it would preempt the day, if you like. So that was quite an adjustment.
Yeah, I think it's children. They squash all of our good practices. You know, they bring much joy with them, but, you know, our window of kind of tolerance is just, I think, just a bit more shrunk for, you know, the particular joyful things that might have kept us well as well. So I'm aware that with clinical psychology, you're employed via NHS trusts to train as a trainee clinical psychologist. Could you tell us a little bit about whether there's funded options available for trainee educational psychologists?
Yes. So my understanding of this, and it might not be the best because it's been quite a while now, but it transferred from master's or MSc to becoming a doctorate, and I think that was in 2000 as well, or 2003, I think it adjusted, changed over. So, but even with the MSc, I think there's the body of educational psychology, the local authorities all joined together, and so there's a funding pot. Previous to the doctorate, you could, for 1 year, you could finance yourself. So some of the applicants would have a unfunded offer, and then there would be funded offers. My understanding now is that there are only funded offers, because I think it's quite a lot to expect anybody over a three-year period to be able to afford.
Are they now doctoral courses, or are they still masters?
Only doctoral courses now.
Okay, because that's different than, I think, health and counselling psychology are self-funding only, and yet it is still the three-year doctorate. It's very tricky.
Oh, okay. It is very tricky, and I think educational psychology has gone through quite a tumultuous time. So I remember when I was training, there was talk about there going to be a period of time where there was going to be a real gap in educational psychologists because there were so many retiring at the same time. I don't know why that occurred, that seemed to be such a kind of bubble, if you like, of people that were retiring, but it feels like we never quite caught up. So there's quite it's heavily in demand, education and child psychology at the moment, but there seems to be a bottleneck because of the funding. There's only ever a certain amount of people that go through the training. And then on the other end, there are so many local authorities that are in desperate need of education and child psychologists.
Yeah, certainly when I worked in CAM services, you know, I think there was an allocation of ed psych hours per school, and it was like 10 hours a term or something like that, you know, it was really minimal. And so you're having to like almost pick your neediest children or young people in the school. But that doesn't mean that there's not lots of other people who also have you know, valid needs for that. It's very tricky. Do you get involved with triaging who to see, or is that a case of the school having to make those referrals?
So part of my journey has been that since 2007, I've pretty much been self-employed. So I work quite differently to a local authority educational psychologist, educational child psychologist. But what ordinarily would happen is the local authority, the educational psychology service, would very, very skillfully and carefully carve out time for each of the schools. And it would be based on things like the priority needs of the school in terms of used to be free school meals, those children that are vulnerable, etc. And they would identify the needs of the school and based on the size of the school as well, and then allocate time. And it was almost always bottom heavy, if you like. So the primary schools would always get more time than the secondary schools. It's always underpinned by early intervention as much as possible.
Thank you for sharing that with us. What's a typical day, if there's such a thing, in the life of an ed psych, specifically you?
Oh. So I might be very different to an ed psych in the local authority. But you did say specifically me, so I will say I do a range of things at the moment. And I think that's a Sagittarian in me. I've always struggled to do one thing at a time. So I do a range. So at the moment, if I look at my diary this week, I am doing some consultation for a company who will be supporting schools with mental health. And they've asked me to have a look at their programme and support them with, you know, sort of highlighting what they could include in the programme, but also emphasising some aspects of the emotional literacy curriculum for them within the programme so they can deliver that to schools. I am offering some supervision and support to an organisation, again, that works with young people. And I'm writing a report. So I locum sometimes for local authorities. And so I work like a local authority educational psychologist, but there is a piecemeal, it's a case-by-case basis. So I'm completing a report today for a very tight deadline, which is constantly my life. What else will I be doing? I'm on podcast, which I'm really happy to be doing as well. So that's today for me. But I'm constantly, I think this is the challenge and the benefit of of independent work, is I'm often offered very different types of work, and that's great. The challenge is I'm always thinking, right, okay, should I? I'm always worried, really, about a gap. So I'm constantly saying yes to things, and after thinking, my goodness, you know, the bucket is full. So it's getting that balance between not saying yes to absolutely everything and ensuring that you have some.
Absolutely,
well.
And I think that's something that we start to begin to be able to learn as aspiring psychologists as well, isn't it? You know, there's lots of people chucking work down at us and we're having to say, I'm only one person.
Exactly.
And I said to you just before we came on camera as well, you know, it's these summer holidays soon, because we're speaking in June. You know, is that a quieter time for you? And you were like, no, not really.
No. Not necessarily, because the schools do close. But, you know, especially skilled SENCOs have been really busy and they're very good at identifying the children that have needs and ensuring that they have put in support for them or requesting support before they leave for the summer. So we're then busy around the summer, you know, we've probably done those assessments previous to, and we'll be writing them up during the summer. Then you have children who will be transferring from primary to secondary school, usually in the following year, but they need to have their annual reviews done, you know, to review it. If they had a education, health and care plan, are their needs still the same as they transition in secondary school, for example?
Would it be okay to briefly outline what an education health plan is for our audience, if that's okay?
Of course. Education, health and care plan. So previously it was known as a statement of educational needs. And what it means is a very small percentage of children they have a higher special educational need than the majority of their peers. It's usually between 0 to 2%. I think they've got quite significant needs. And so even though the school is putting in as much support as they can, asking for advice and support on the outside, they feel, and the parents often feel, that without additional funding and additional support, they'll not be able to reach their full potential and will struggle and have a kind of a challenging experience at school. So the education, health and care plan is about all the professionals that work with the young person offering advice, if you like. So we as educational psychologists usually do that via some form of consultation and assessment with the school, the parent and the child. It's varied and it's become more complex over the whole lockdown period, because usually it was always ever face to face. But during lockdown, it became more remote. So some of the work I'm doing now is remote, and I'm engaging with young people online, as it were. So the whole idea of the educational health and care plan is for all the professionals that are working with the young person and their family to put all the information in one space. And that space, that educational health and care plan, all that information is then viewed by what's known as the SEN panel. So every local authority has a special educational needs panel. And the idea of it is that it's quite representative. So you'll have usually school heads or school SENCOs will take turns in attending the panel at the local authority. You'll have the special educational needs department from the local authority. You'll have an educational psychologist on there. And sometimes, time permitting, you'll have somebody from health as well. So that panel then meets on a weekly basis. And what they do is look at the requests for an educational health and care plan, and they'll decide on which ones they think are in need of a further assessment and which aren't. And they'll also look at the educational health and care plan information for each child and decide on whether they think that it warrants them at this point having some additional support. And if that's agreed, then the educational health and care plan is written. Now, this is a plan that follows a child from 0 to 25 years old. So it's earmarked funding for a young person throughout their educational career, if you like.
Okay, thank you so much for that. I know that will be really useful for people trying to navigate their way through psychology, and perhaps if they're working with educational service as well, or perhaps if they just want to, you know. It's often abbreviated, isn't it? Could you tell us the abbreviation that people might be seeing?
So the Educational Health and Care Plan is EHCP. EHCP, Educational Health and Care Plan.
And do you ever work alongside aspiring psychologists, or, you know, how can people get experience of working alongside people like you in your profession?
It's a question that I every so often I think, should I get an associate, should I not, you know, or an assistant, psychologist. So I probably could do. I think it's very much about the type of ways that you work in, because I work in quite an eclectic way. I think I'd find it quite challenging to support an assistant psychologist at this point. But I think most local authorities, people keep knocking on their doors. I know there are issues around GDPR, etc. But most local authorities will be open to having a discussion with somebody who is considering educational child psychology. It is a bit more challenging to do shadowing, if you like, for a day because of safeguarding issues, etc. But it's not impossible to do some work around an educational psychology service. But again, that's changed so much, and so much has changed since the pandemic. So the way local authorities are set up, so most of the local authorities that I've worked in since the pandemic are working on a skeleton within the office, really. And people are very much just going in to pick up their materials and then working at home, really. So it's very different to when I first started out. So that might be a challenge for you know, being able to shadow somebody. But I don't think it's impossible. So it pretty much is very much about approaching the local authority and asking. I think it's important to say that the educational psychology role again has changed, because there are so many people that are now leaving the training and becoming independent psychologists almost immediately. When I first started, it was very much frowned upon because it felt that you needed to do your foundation within a psychology service. But that seems to be quite different now. So people are becoming independent much earlier on. So there are different organisations out there, if you like, or groups of associates. So again, it might be helpful for an aspiring psychologist to approach one of the many organisations that are out there, obviously ensuring that their psychologists are HCPC registered, etc. But
Because that you need to be, you're part of the practitioner psychologist cluster, aren't you? The same as clinical Absolutely. Psychologists. Yeah, so you'd need to be registered with the Health and Care Professions Council. They definitely added an extra P in there at some point, didn't they? It used to be shorter than that. Lovely. You mentioned Sagittariusness. I'm a Gemini, and it made me think about, you know, oh, maybe that's why I like to, you know, have lots of things going on. But has, you know, has spirituality, culture and faith been important to you in your journey as an aspiring psychologist and beyond, Michelle?
I think absolutely. Very important. In fact, I think it's become more so. Obviously, sort of definitions of all the things that you've mentioned are very different for different people and mean different things. But I think my intention around life has certainly changed as I've developed experience and grown in my profession. I've always been a believer, you know, in God, etc. Although I've always found it quite challenging to find a specific space, because I'm quite eclectic with my thinking and my processes around belief. And quite early on in my career, I started to become curious about neuropsychology, the idea that you can, you know, sort of intend things, if you like, into your life, focus your thoughts in a direction and the behaviour seems to follow. So I've been really interested in that type of research. Quite early on, I trained an emotional freedom technique, EFT, tapping, which I've always really enjoyed and always found really helpful. So that's very much a stay of my practice at the moment. And hypnotherapy, which I know there's been, it's ranged, hasn't it, in its popularity, I think, hypnotherapy. But again, it's been something that's been really helpful for me, and I've promoted in my practice as well.
So I know that in NHS and funded LEA services, we can often have to kind of stick to NICE guidance and kind of tried and trusted approaches that have got a firm evidence base. And hypnotherapy is something that lots of clients ask for or, you know, inquire about, but it's not necessarily registered or regulated or recognised by the NHS, for example. But does it free you up to use that more within private practice?
It does. I think, again, ensuring that you use correct CPD and training, etc. I think things with hypnotherapy, I think I'm a bit more comfortable in using, and EFT, because the research is developing all of the time. So there's quite, even though it's a challenge, because obviously it's not as conventional as other practices are, it's helpful that there is positive research, you know, out there in terms of outcomes for others. And I do feel that sense of freedom of being able to use it much more so than I probably would do if I was working entirely for a local authority.
Yeah, absolutely. It, you know, it allows us to have the freedom when working in private practice to do what's going to work for that client, so long as it's ethically sound, of course, which of course I know it would be. Lovely. Have you got any advice for people that might be listening to this that might think, oh, yeah, I think educational psychology might be a good route for me? What could they do, or what should they do? What would be a good first step? For example, if they were, I don't know, A-level students, or if they were doing their psychology degree right now.
Funny enough, I just spoke to an A-level student who's thinking about, psychology. It wasn't just necessarily educational psychology. But I was saying to her, get a good sense of what you're really interested in, what is it that you would like to get out of your career, you know. And I think we were speaking about that earlier, the idea of connecting and connecting with people. I think it's really important. I would say, secondly, it's really, really, if I did my time again, I think it would have been really important to get that shadowing in much earlier on and get a sense of what the job looks like on a day-to-day basis. So knock on much more doors, ask for that, you know, opportunity to do that. Find out as much as you can about education and child psychology. So it's not this kind of myth. So I think sometimes I speak to young people and they think it's going to be this sense of just, you know, sitting with a child. Sometimes it almost like psychotherapy, and it's not like that at all. So just getting a sense of what it looks like, you know, a child and educational psychology. And then familiarise yourself with that area, familiarise yourself with schools, get some experience. So even though you don't have to be a teacher anymore, you do have to show an understanding of the educational experience and the provision and educational provision. So get some experience in those areas.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Is there anything that I haven't asked you which you think I should have done or might have been useful for me to ask so far?
That's an interesting question. I think joy. What do I enjoy about the role, or do I enjoy it? And what I would say is I do think it was the role and has been the role for me. The topic, psychology as a heading. I've always been interested in people and the mind, etc. So it does bring me joy, even in the most challenging moments. I would say that I've enjoyed it as a profession. You know,
that is such an important answer, and it's something I do with clients quite often. As we'll have a bit of a joy audit, you know, we'll look at which areas of our life we're getting joy from, because it is supposed to be enjoyable, isn't it? If it's not feeling enjoyable, then it might be that it's, you know, it could be many reasons, couldn't it? It could be that you haven't got a good fit with your psychology supervisor. It could be that there's just too much work and you're being kind of consumed by it. You know, it might not just be that it's you that's the problem. It's worth looking at some other factors as well, isn't it? And with that in mind, I often ask my guests, if you've got any advice to support people from reducing burnout when they are aspiring psychologists, what would be your top tips?
I would say, when you diarise for the week, you write your diary about what you're going to do for the week. Again, enter in something that's completely different, you know, and have that kind of tea morning, well-being morning, well, something that is included within that week, because it can become really intense. And I would say, as an independent psychologist, quite lonely as well. So I often try and booking engaging times with others. So it's not just this kind of sole time on your own.
Many of our audience are probably working remotely as well, aren't they? So I know remote working can also foster that feeling. I do what you say, really. You know, I book lunch and brunch dates, you know. I connect with people through the podcast and more widely as well. But being connected to something, you know, that's not just you sitting by yourself tapping away is really
absolutely
key, isn't it? Lovely.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining me, Michelle. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you. How could people get in contact with you if they wanted to send referrals your way or learn more about your work?
I've been a bit naff on social media, I have to say, but I do have a LinkedIn page and I have a Facebook page, both with the same name, Dr. Michelle McDowell
on LinkedIn. Yeah. So what I will do is I will make sure I pop links to your socials and your website or whatever you need in the show notes for this episode. But thank you so much for opening our eyes to this really important area of psychology, which is education and child psychology. And let us know if we can do anything for you or with you in future. And thank you so much for your time. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you found everything that Dr. Michelle and I had to say really useful. If you'd like to read Michelle's story And for that matter, lots and lots of other qualified psychologists' stories, including, of course, clinical psychology, but also including health psychology, counselling psychology, forensic psychology, and academic roots into psychology. You can most definitely do so by checking out the Clinical Psychologist Collective book, which you can grab from Amazon, or for ease, you can click on the link in the show notes. Don't forget that the Aspiring Psychologist membership is opening just for another 15 people on the 1st of July. So get yourself on that waiting list and then you can swoop in there as soon as it opens at 8 a.m. On the 1st of July. And that's just £30 a month. And there is a ton of value in there, even for you to catch up. But each month we have a live group Zoom with myself, where we do go through professional and personal issues. There is live CBT teaching and formulation sessions. We've got stuff coming up on research. We've got trainings that go in every month. There's opportunities each week to ask me anything you like. And so it's a really great resource, and there's a really nice community spirit in there. People are really supportive and kind. So if you feel like you're missing your tribe, or you haven't yet stumbled across them, or it's feeling a bit lonely, or you're not receiving, you know, quality clinical supervision, perhaps you're just not with someone who you think gets you or is furthering your skills, then why not come and top that up so that you can get the optimal experiences from your occupational employment. Yes, right. I hope you have enjoyed today's episode, and I will look forward to catching up with you very soon for the next time our podcast pops in, because you should be subscribed, really, at 6 a.m. every Monday. And don't forget, you can always catch up on all of the replays, which are available through your usual podcast channels, but, you know, Spotify, Apple, Google, Amazon, all those good places. So do listen to the back catalogue, and I will be along with the next episode very soon. Take care. Have a lovely day.
If you're looking to become a psychologist, then let this be your guide. With this podcast at your side, you'll be on your way to being qualified. It's the Aspiring Psychologist Podcast. Dr. Marianne Trent.
My name's Yana, and I'm a trainee psychological wellbeing practitioner. I read the Clinical Psychologist Collective book. I found it really interesting about all the different stories and how people got to become a clinical psychologist. It just amazed me how many different routes there are to get there, and there's no perfect way to become one. And this kind of filled me with confidence that no, I'm not doing it wrong, and put less pressure on myself. So if you're feeling a bit uneasy about becoming a clinical psychologist, I'd definitely recommend this, just to put yourself at ease, and everything will be okay. But trust me, you will not put the book down once you start.